When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
A 1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone. Today, Amy Wright sits down with Jed Hilly, Executive Director of the Americana Music Association, which, since 1999, has helped American roots music assume an elevated place in the world. Hilly's career has included work for Orbison Records, Sony Music Entertainment, and various other notable organizations. Following the 9/11 disaster in 2001, Jed relocated his family from New York to Nashville, and in the spring of 2007, he accepted a position as Executive Director at the Americana Music Association, where he continues today. We're excited for you to learn more about his story and the work he's doing that positively affects so many lives in the music industry. So let's get to it. From Diddy TV, here's Jed Hilly with Amy Wright on Insights.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York and in Vermont. My family had a farm in Vermont. I think there's a Dylan line which says it's not a house, it's a home. And that home for me was Vermont, but I went to school in New York, in the suburbs of New York City, and lived up in Vermont for some of my first 18 years, but then traveled a lot, traveled all around, I don't know, 34 different countries between the ages of 18 and 26. I kind of had a bug that I just had to follow, and that was a good bug, a travel bug.
Well, were you playing music as a kid, or?
No, I was not, but by, you know, I didn't go straight to college. I went to Europe, and I grew an appreciation for art, particularly in Italy. I was staying in a pensione in Rome, and one of the people who were lodging a few doors down from me was a Fulbright scholar studying the Baroque period of art. And we became friends about, you know, 2 days into my stay. And I just hung out for 3 weeks with this guy because he could take me behind the altar of the church you've never heard of, because he was a Fulbright scholar. And he exposed me to Bernini and Borromini and just all that is incredible, that is the artwork, not only, you know, that lives in, you know, the incredible artwork that's in the Vatican and all the great museums of Rome, but what's on the street. And I just, you know, grew a fascination for all art forms, really during that period. I mean, I was, I went through my early, you know, growing up in Vermont, we would go to bluegrass festivals and fiddle contests all the time. And I merged my way through my Grateful Dead era and Joni Mitchell and Bonnie Raitt and Neil Young. That was sort of, those were my foundational music roots. And then I just developed this passion for art and artists in the broader scope. Which strangely enough, many years later, I like to liken Americana musicians as artists, and I don't even like to call them Americana artists, but I do believe that just as there is commercial art that you see in magazines and online advertising, like that's commercial art and that has a value and that's a good thing, but then there's fine art, and I consider Americana to be a fine art, and it's not consumed by commercial necessity. It's consumed by the intent of the artist. And it's the making of a great song. I mean, I love that, you know, not to go on a tangent, but I love that Dylan and T-Bone just re-recorded Blowin' in the Wind, and they made one copy, and they sold it for what, $1.8 million or $1.6 million? Like, that's the essence. And I was excited to see that announcement, if only to put forth the notion that music can be an art form, and it's not, which can be for the masses, it's just how do we translate that. But well, so that was my upbringing.
Well, one of the things you said sort of reminded me of, you went on to describe Americana music as an art form, but when you talked about Italy and the art there, if you've ever been to the Sistine Chapel and you go to the Vatican, what struck me was you went through all these other smaller chapels that were equally as extraordinary.
Yeah.
Before and after the Sistine Chapel, with all these other artists that were not Michelangelo.
Yeah.
They were other amazing artists. Right. And so you can sort of liken Americana a little bit like that. So you've got the bigger artists. So you've got the Sistine Chapel, but you've got all of that, those artists that kind of lead up to that and beyond. And it's just, you know, amazing music that's coming out these days. You know, we track it obviously at Diddy TV, but just how many young people are playing such a broad scope of music is incredible.
Oh, I love that, Amy. And I think you're absolutely right. Mary Gaucher once was, she said, Jed, what you're doing with Americana is working to build careers, not write one hit song. And that's, I think, very true of our community, if you will, is, you know, we are fostering career growth. I mean, you know, how many of our artists, you know, hit 35 and 40 and, you know, boom, Chris Stapleton, boom, Brandi Carlile. You know, it's not uncommon in our world. Mary, of course, being, in my opinion, sort of the quintessential artist who sold her restaurants in Boston after she was 40 years old, went to Nashville and, you know, wrote Mercy Now and is, you know, I think one of the greatest songwriters of our time. And she's out there day in and day out. And she's, you know, selling, you know, 200, 300, 400 seat rooms and standing at her table and selling her CDs and making a good little business for herself. And what an extraordinary feat for a woman to start in the music business at the age of 40. And then, you know, I do like to tell younger artists when they're like, you know, what do I do? And it's like, well, it's a long haul and you need to be true to your passion. If you want to get into the songwriting world and have a country music artist make a hit, you know, that would be the commercial art form that lives over there. But if you want to be true to your art and you want to see your passion and your creation through, you got to be prepared to get in a van and drive from town to town. And, you know, when it's a hit, it's a hit. And, but in the meantime, you can build a beautiful career out of it.
When did you get into the music business? I know you worked for Sony, and were you doing something musically before you got the job at Sony, or how did that happen?
Yeah, I was in a band and playing in a band, and I was working at Tortilla Flats on West 12th and Washington Street in New York City, which was a fantastic dive that just closed just a couple of years ago. But it was a blast. I had a lot of good friends there. And our mariachi band didn't show up one New Year's Eve around 1986. I'm dating myself. And my buddy Steve called me and said, what are we going to do, the mariachi band? Like, I'm thinking we start our own band. So the employees of Tortilla Flats got together. We didn't have a drummer. We used a drum machine, but four of us got together who worked in the restaurant. And we, like 2 days before New Year's Eve, and we wrote six songs, and we were all working New Year's Eve. So right at like midnight, we all stopped working. Whoever wanted a drink couldn't get it, because we got together in the corner and we played six songs. Well, people loved it. And before 2 o'clock in the morning came, as we were all celebrating the new year, we were offered another gig 2 weeks later, and that was crazy. And then there was a guy named Angel Quinones who played in a band called Conk. That was a smoking band in New York in the 80s. And another dude named George Fontaine Jr., whose father, I think, may have toured the world with Art Blakey. He was like sophisticated jazz dude who was like, that was really good. You guys need a drummer. So we added Angel on congas and like the most incredible percussion section we could have had. And I was the bass player, which I never played bass before. So it was like ridiculous because I was playing with two of the greatest percussionists in New York City at the time. And that ran its course. We had a great time. But as most bands experience, we combusted.
Spontaneously or?
it was more or less over time. You know, there was a lot of love and a lot of passion going around it at that time. And maybe a little too much passion and too much love. But I still love all my old bandmates. And part of my role, I just took on the role as being the manager of the band. So I was dealing with a lot of the business. And out of that, one of my regular customers was a great dude named Roger Christian, who worked for Sony Music. And when he found out I quit the band and I was somewhat sullen, he was like, well, you got a job in the, on the other side of the music business if you want it. Like, you're good at what you do. So I took that job at Sony. And it was the bottom. I was looking at the bottom rung of the ladder when I took that job, but I was a little older than college students who were like, that was like, it was an intern type of a job at Sony. And, but I decided it was time for me to be humble, and it was graduate school in the music business for the next 10 years.
So what kind of roles did you have while you were there? I know it's kind of ran the gamut. We'll get to the end of it because I think it's pretty interesting where you kind of landed at Sony. But what were some of the roles you had?
It was funny. Pearl Jam's coming to Nashville on September 16th, and I was in touch with a friend of mine who works with them, and we were talking about my first job at Sony. One of the things I had to do was I looked after the inventories of Tower Records. So I would go into Tower Records and make sure they had enough Pearl Jam CDs. At the time, it was their. I arrived there just as Pearl Jam's first album was coming out. And they were going to, I was responsible for making sure they were coming to do an in-store performance, acoustic performance. It's like 1991, maybe 1992, I can't remember, but it was 30 years ago. And Eddie and the Motley Crue, not Motley Crue, Eddie and Pearl Jam, who were a Motley Crue, I like drove in a van from one Tower Records to another Tower Records, and they'd do like a 20-minute acoustic set. And it was a meet and greet. So I would then say, if you want to, you know, I've got Sharpies, please form a line. It was like 100 people there in a record store. That was one of my first responsibilities, at Sony Music, which was pretty crazy when you look back on it. I went through that. I got promoted, pretty quickly, and ended up in the national office on 52nd Street. And then, where I worked at Sony Music Distribution. I was responsible for retail marketing. I then moved over to international marketing, where I looked after global logistics and how do we get a Bruce Springsteen album to Australia and Europe and the six major manufacturing plants around the world without anybody stealing it. Those were the days of piracy. Like I would literally send my staff with a master to Brazil to have it, like to hand deliver it to the Sony representative at the manufacturing site in Sao Paulo and in Australia, in Asia, in Holland, in Austria, wherever our manufacturing sites. And then I moved into a little more creative where I was Creed's product manager, international product manager for Sony. for a couple of years, which was a wild ride.
I bet that was fun.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, at the time, 97, 98, 99, they were about the biggest band in the world, to be honest. We sold 32 million albums. They sold 32 million albums. I mean, it was a great run. And that period was the advent of Napster. And I was tasked to, I left my position to a corporate position where I was tasked with working with six other people to figure out, we were called the Napster response team. It was like, what do we do? So we digitized all of the assets for Sony. My specific job was to figure out how, because of my international experience, how do we get the artwork, the publicity photos, all of the assets transmitted digitally. This was about 2000, 99, 2000.
I mean, was Sony surprised by Napster, or did they see that coming on some level?
They didn't see it coming. I don't know. There's certain things when I left 20 years ago, I had to sign a document that said I wouldn't say anything about it. But no, there were people inside. I mean, I remember holding up a box of cigarettes and in a senior executive meeting and said, have any of you been in the subway lately? And they all had drivers. They didn't go in the subway. And I said, well, guys, if it doesn't fit in this box, teenagers don't care anymore. You're all fighting about encrypting a CD so that you can't make a recording of it. They don't care. Like, you got to figure out how to embrace this. I mean, I didn't know, but I knew enough to know that when I was a teenager and in my early 20s, I used to buy Maxell tapes and I would make a mixtape and I would give it to a friend who would give me one that they made and I'd hear five songs I liked and I went to the record store and bought them. So I knew something was wrong in the philosophy at a pretty senior level. I mean, that one meeting, I thought I was going to get fired when I made that statement. And but they didn't fire me and they let me do what I was tasked to do. And it was very interesting. The initiative actually created a fantastic website, which looks an awful lot like Spotify today. And it was the Sony version of Napster that came out of that. But they just missed the boat. They were just a little behind the eight ball. And I think the industry made, you know, they were suing 16-year-olds for ripping music off of Napster, which was just ridiculous. That was not the way to win over hearts.
You know, it seems like that was sort of that right in that transition, and it happened very fast where, artists were making a lot of money, big artists were making a lot of money off of record sales, and really they didn't have to charge a lot when they toured for tickets because they made so much money off of their record sales, and then it just whoosh, flipped to where they couldn't make the same money off record sales, and so they had to charge more for tickets. I mean, it's got to go one way or the other. You know, people have to make a living, so.
Well, and money was, you know, flowing like wine. I mean, once CDs took hold in 92, 93, you know, I remember my wife at the time in the early mid 90s got me a CD player and I was like, I didn't want it. Well, you know, then you had to go, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who kind of went through that. I mean, I kept my turntable. I still have my turntable, but you had to go like resupply your whole collection. So the labels are making money off the albums, off the CD, you know, but now if you want your Sly and the Family Stone fresh album, you got to go buy it on CD. Because
I hadn't thought about that. That's so true.
Yeah. So it's like they started all, so they had so much money. You know, those were the days of the $900,000 MTV video budget. What? Like, I can do it on this for nothing.
Right.
I mean, seriously, unbelievable, right? I remember $900,000 Creed budget. That's 98. That's a lot of money.
That is nuts. Well, yeah. And in all of this, right in the middle of it all, I guess is when the AMA started, right? Around 99. You weren't working there then.
No.
But how did the AMA get started?
So it was a reaction, interestingly enough, to the commercial country marketplace saying, you know, determining that they were no longer interested in Johnny Cash. And of course, you probably recall the great Billboard ad with that Rick Rubin and Johnny took out after they won Grammys for the best country album. And, you know, Johnny's flipping the bird. Such a great photograph. But that was the time. And, you know, like I said, it became a totally 100% commercial country marketplace led by Garth Brooks and Shania Twain. God bless them both. But to the detriment of artists of integrity, from Roseanne Cash to you know, Lyle to Dwight Yoakam, for crying out loud. Simultaneously, you had that alt country movement, you know, the Jayhawks, you had Wilco, before that Uncle Tupelo, you know, these great hipster bands that was creating a cool thing in the early 90s, but it was still hard to get a foothold with major labels. So the Americana Music Association, there's a bunch of people who were like, we got to do something. They got together, about 33 of them got together in Austin during South by Southwest in the spring of 1999. And they said, you know, they set the parameters of what they wanted to do. They decided that Nashville, being a music industry community, and from which Americana was spawned by country music business rejection, effectively. So they got together again in I think the first weekend of October in 1999, and they voted to form a union, and it was called the Americana Music Association, and they created a board, and everybody reached into their wallet, and you know, they had an envelope and a silent contribution. You could give as much as you want. And they got enough money to kick off the association. They hired my colleague, Dana Strong, as the very first employee.
Dana was there from the beginning? I don't think
Dana,
I knew that.
Dana volunteered for that meeting in October to pour coffee and to, you know, just help out. She was just, you know, she was living in Nashville. She wanted to help out. And she did. And then it was like, well, hey, you know, you like this music. So they initially did that. It was a board run event. They started a membership. They all chipped in. It was 100% working board. A year or so later, they hired J.D. May, who came before me 20 years ago. And 2 years later, Allison Moorer was on the board, and she said, we need an award show. And it was her recommendation and her idea, as she sat on the board trying to think of things to do, that spawned the first award show in 2001.
So how did they define Americana then? Because we're going to get to how we define it now, but how were they defining it when they started the association?
Well, I came in 2007, and in my first board meeting, I said, we have a problem. My dad, the Christmas before I started, I went home and I asked my dad what he thought about me taking this job. And at the time I was working for Mrs. Orbison, looking after the estate of Roy Orbison, his collection and the archives. And
well, that had to be interesting.
Yeah, it was great. We did an exhibit at the Rock Hall, and we had a petition to get Roy a postage stamp. And it was a great experience, a great run. And I was, you know, well paid. And these people approached me about taking this job. And I said, Pop, what do you think? And my dad said, well, is the definition of Americana in the dictionary as a music form? And we looked it up, and it wasn't there. And he sort of over his shoulder was like, I wouldn't take the job, and went back out to garden. So I decided my dad didn't think it was the best idea. Therefore, I should probably take the job.
Of course.
And being the rebellious child that I was. So I'm there at my first board meeting. And the first thing I did a week before my first board meeting was I wrote Merriam-Webster's dictionary and said, why isn't this word in the dictionary? And I clicked and they wrote me back amazingly and said, you please don't start a petition. Like, we are Merriam-Webster since 1848. We've been determining the vernacular of the American English language and we look at this every day. Thank you. Go away. And so I clicked my Outlook button to remind me every 3 months to write Merriam-Webster, which I did. I went to the board and I was like, you know, what's the deal here? And they had the philosophy akin to the Supreme Court philosophy about a Larry Flynn issue. And they said, well, we can't describe it, but we know it when we see it. And that was the prevailing theory of the Americano board at the time. We don't know how to define it, but we know it when we hear it. So I worked on changing that, which I think was beneficial. And effectively, over the years, I convinced, well, 4 years after I wrote my first letter to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, the managing editor of Merriam-Webster calls the office and we had an intern come in and say, Jed, somebody from Merriam-Webster's is on the phone. Would like to speak to you. And he said, I thought you should be the first to know that we are adding the term, musical term Americana, nice, to our most prestigious collegiate dictionary. And their definition as of 2011 was that which is, it's an American musical genre which honors and derives from folk and country traditions, which is pretty much what I was telling them. And I did write them every 3 months for 4 years before getting that phone call. And then today, I think it has evolved. And my thoughts on what is Americana have evolved. And I try not to put sort of my own perspective on it. But the one thing that I do know is the Americana Music Association was started as a reaction to have been excluded from the business process. That was the music industry as we knew it in 1999. And today, I think my greatest goal is to remember what it was like to have been excluded. And my goal is to not be exclusive. My goal is to have a primary focus on being inclusive, because I don't know what kind of album Emmylou Harris is going to make next time, or Brandi Carlile, or Bonnie Raitt, or Mavis Staples. Mavis is an interesting example of one of the first people I was able to be part of honoring. We honored Mavis in 2007 at the first award show I was part of. She didn't come. And it took many years, well, 12 years before I finally got Mavis to our award show in 2019 to properly present her with the award that we had initially given to her in 2007. And I think in that time, slowly but surely, you know, we've been determined to acknowledge the input, creativity, and even some of the origins of what is Americana as it relates to people of color. You know, I'm certainly of the mind that somewhere behind me here in Nashville, Tennessee, there were many, many different cultures around the turn of the 19th century, 1880 to, you know, 1920, and even going further back 100 years, who were you know, French Canadian, Spanish, Portuguese, African American slaves who brought the banjo from Africa, who met, you know, the Scots and Irish and English who were migrating westward to go find oil, rather gold, and, you know, were bringing their guitars and their fiddles. And, you know, that's where the banjo met the fiddle, right in my backyard somewhere. So that being open to that, trying to have that be as organic as possible, which is how music changes, you know. What is Americana today is not what it was Americana in 2001. In 2001, 1999, it was Emmy, and it was Lyle Lovett, and it was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Today, it still is Emmy, and it's Sturgill Simpson, and it's Yola, and it's Alison Russell, and it's Brandy, and it's Bonnie. It's Jackson Brown, and it's Anderson East. It's William Bell. It's honoring the music that came before us. And like great artists do, they pull from history for inspiration and create something new for the future.
I mean, do you think that Americana is a home for a lot of the independent artists? And there's the big, what I would say, the big genres of just pop. Let's just call it all pop. And then you've got
the big
urban
pop?
Music. But there's so much more music out there. And are you defining that? And are you giving a home to these artists?
Well, I think the majors have been a little slow to see the longevity of these artists, like we were talking about before. I mean, I think Mary's right. I think the Americana Music Association is part of giving artists a home to build a career. Mm-hmm. And they're not reliant, as other industries are, in this town, in Los Angeles, in New York, on that big hit, or that big commercial, or that big soundtrack. You know, they're building fan bases town by town, city by city, show by show, stream by stream. You know, it's like it's, you know, radio airplay. I mean, spin by spin. I think Americana provides a philosophy of and work ethic, whether we like it or not, that is required. You know, the business model that we are espousing is like, you're going to have to work hard. Like, this ain't going to come easy, but you can make a living and you can live your passion. And, you know, I could be asking, you know, paper or plastic, ma'am, as a job, or I'd be sitting behind a plexiglass teller window, you know, giving you your money and keeping a job is an admirable trait. And lots of people need to have jobs to do various things. You know, when I was in my band, I worked in a restaurant to butter my bread, but my bread was performing live, and you know, that's what I love to do. I think Americana is a community that at this point is established, and it works in the long term. You know, you can have a career in the music business if you follow your dreams. And I mean, the community doesn't like people who sell out so much, which can be a challenge for me, because how do you determine selling out because someone's successful? when I was in college and, you know, after the Clash's, you know, third album, I was kind of like, oh, you know, what are they doing now? You know, it's like, why should I discredit them because they achieved a modicum of success, or the Talking Heads, or, you know, anybody else from that generation? It's like that I fight, and that I think lives in the Americana, you know, the snarky purists that live in this world. But I think they too can see that we are a home for artists big and small. I mean, you've been to Americana, and you can, you know, you can, you know, walk into, you know, one of our clubs and see Lucinda Williams there, to see another act that's playing at Americana Fest. Or, you know, I remember Grace Potter, before she became an established artist, coming in 2008 and, you know, walking up to T-Bone Burnett. And, you know, that happens. You know, getting in an elevator with Bonnie Raitt. I mean, that happens. And that's inspiring, I think, for the next generation of artists who commune in this world. They're, you know, I've worked with a lot of different artists and a lot of different genres, particularly through my career at Sony. These are the nicest artists that I've met across all genres.
Okay,
no disrespect intended, but.
No, but they are. They're incredibly nice artists. And, you know, they come in our studio and we tape them, and they're nice, respectful, and they're drinking their tea and getting ready to play, and so creative. And we talk about the fact that as a genre, there's so much great video content. We were shocked when we started Diddy that there was so much video content out there. It was almost like there was also a film world in the Americana world. But what do you see? Let's finish here. What do you see as the future of the association and Americana in general, and or kind of like, what are your goals for the organization and the genre?
Well, like everyone, it's been quite a ride the last couple of years, and we almost didn't make it. We almost didn't make it in 2008 during the recession. I am convinced that the survival of our organization at its roots was grassroots. And so I think it's really important, as executive director of the association, to always be mindful of that. You know, it's also my job to push to the future. It's, you know, my job to, you know, get sponsorships, but I'm not getting a sponsorship from Halliburton. I have to pick and choose based on what I know the at least what I perceive the community I represent to believe in, which isn't always easy moving forward. We've been broke for 20 years, but we've always made it. When we hit the pandemic, you may recall, you know, my first blush was, this is going to be over in 3 months. 2020 festival is going to rock. And by May of 2020, we realized that wasn't a possibility. And we had just started a foundation, a C3 charitable and educational organization as a side company, a separate entity unto its own, who would focus more on the education side of what is Americana. And we didn't quite know what was going to come from it. And so we decided to do Thriving Roots, which was our online title, the title of our online presentation for the fall of 2020, because we couldn't do Americana Fest, and we didn't want to call it Americana Fest online, because Americana Fest, as you well know, is about like hanging out,
right,
as much as it is about listening to music, experiencing a live show. I mean, it's all a great hang, Americana Fest. We couldn't do that, so we came up with Thriving Roots. Jackson Brown had agreed to be on our foundation board. And what Jackson wanted to do was, he wanted us to focus on the foundation and educational side on capturing the stories of people, friends, in fact, of his that were here before it was too late. Mm-hmm. And we were like, sure, who do you want to talk to? He said, Mavis. I want to interview Mavis. It's like, oh, okay. We could put that in the Thriving Roots thing. And then I called Roseanne Cash, his manager, and I said, this is what we're looking to do. Is there something Roseanne would like to do? We're just putting it out there. Well, The next day, she wants a Zoom call with me and Dana and her manager, Danny, and we all get on the phone together. And she says, I want to do a virtual panel on the history of protest music. And I'm going to call my friends, Ry Cooter, Bonnie Raitt, and Angela Davis. It's like, oh, that's kind of huge. There's our second panel for Thriving Roots. And what we did was we put out to the community, primarily to artists, as well as some of our business community, but we put it out. Emmy Lou Harris, will you talk with Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan about country 1 year later? You know, Ken's, you know, definitive documentary on country music to come out in 2019. Let's take a look at it in 2020 with the people who, you know, created it and, you know, our, you know, and an artist who was featured mightily in that documentary. We reached out to Judd Apatow, who had made a documentary on the Avets, and said, hey, y'all want to get together and talk? We reached out to the Lumineers and say, hey, is there something that you want to do? And they said, yeah, we want to talk to M. Night Shyamalan. What? Okay. So it really was inspiring as far as what we're looking at doing now. There is Americana Fest. That is our in-person family reunion. There is also the foundation, and we've partnered with NYU, and Roseanne was our first Americana artist in residence at NYU, which is like kind of cool. And we did that program. We barely did it. We had to cancel parts of it because of COVID, but we did that. We're about to announce our next Americana artist in residence at NYU for this fall. Where we're going in the future, to me, is it is an expansive model. We've got our home. We've got our family reunion in Americana Fest. We're partnering with the biggest university in the nation. We, you know, in 2 weeks, as we do every year, we partner with Lincoln Center. We're doing a salute to Ray Charles with the Warren Treaty. So, you know, we're hitting some important cultural associations and partnerships that I think is our responsibility for the future of the Americana Music Association and Foundation now. Every year we seem to have a new project. I've never stayed in a job for 15 years before. And here I am. I just, what's so, as a palate, as a working environment and a palate, it seems every year I'm gifted with a new color that I had never seen or heard before. And it's a great challenge, and it's a great community. And I just love adding to it.
Well, I think you've done an amazing job at running the AMA and taking it to another level and really providing this incredible space for all these amazing artists that we all love. And I wish you the best. I can't wait to see you at AMA. I really appreciate you stopping by and talking to us a little bit about yourself and the AMA.
All right, folks, we're wrapping up another hour of conversation here on Diddy TV. Big thanks to Jed Hilly for taking the time to connect with us and to share about his life and the passion that drives his work at the Americana Music Association, the force behind one of the greatest festivals and conferences around, Americana Fest, held every September in Nashville, Tennessee, and featuring an incredibly inspiring mix of up-and-coming and A-list talent. You can learn more about Jed and the Americana Music Association by visiting AmericanaMusic.org. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.